If you enjoyed this program, please sign up for our podcast at lifebetweenthevines.com.
Stories we like to tell is like when getting up early in the morning with our dad, we used to go out and meet up with our uncles and work in the fields.
He was always into the winemaking side, but just did homemade stuff. But everyone loved it.
As members of the family, presenting the wines ourselves, it's very important for us. And I think it's important for people as well to put a face on the wine.
I was born and raised here. I love the family history. I love the seasons. So somewhere deep down, I knew I was coming back.
It evolved. It started with wanting to grow grapes.
We say, so drink the wine. Discovering and tasting wine shouldn't be a homework assignment. And we believe that the people who are closest to wine have the best stories. So open a bottle.
And welcome to podcast number 415. This week we feature wine consultant Jean Hoflinger, Napa Valley. Fermented grape juice runs through the blood of wine consultant Jean Hoflinger. If you've ever met him, you already know this. His enthusiasm, passion, and love for the grape bleeds into every conversation, peppered with his dry wit and humor. Jean makes wine all over the world, educating wine lovers of all types. We spoke with Jean just a couple of weeks ago to get caught up on his latest projects, as well as just to chat with our old friend. You can hear Jean on our Vino Lingo segment, defining the term balance. If I could be on the phone with anybody right now from Napa Valley, this would be the one guy. I'm on the phone with our good friend, Jean Hoflinger. How you doing, Jean?
I'm holding up like most of the country after a fairly challenging year.
Very challenging. So Jean has his own wine consulting company, JH Wine Consulting, and of course, Jean is in Napa Valley. We've known him for more years than I care to think about, and it's always fun to have you on the line. Glad you're doing well during this pandemic and all the insanity going on here.
Well, thanks for having me. It's always fun to be able to talk to people you consider friends like you.
Same here. It's a shame we can't do it in person, but it's nice to still be in touch. Man, everybody's had a crazy year in 2020, but being in Napa Valley, dealing with the fires, dealing with the smoke issues, that's got to be something that keeps you awake at night.
Yeah, there's a few different things that get me, you know, awake at night this year. The pandemic, because it's a healthcare issue, and I think as soon as it touches lives, I think it's really the most important. And when you think about the fires, and that's kind of a good segue, I think one of the things we learned from previous fires is actually how to save lives. And so we had very little, if none, casualties during these fires. And I think that's the first important thing. The second that is not, unfortunately, as hopeful is the fact that we're seeing a recurrence of a fire and it happening in Northern California. And I think it's really key now that we identify what can be done to better that situation in the current state of the climate today. Not talking about the future, not talking about the past, but understanding what can be changed today.
That's a really good point. So what would you change as a winemaker?
As a winemaker, first I would rethink, obviously, forest management laws, because I think that it brings a civil duty and a civil obligation to people to be able to understand what they can do first on their own property. And, of course, the same concept and laws should be applied to the government and the land that the government, controls, as what can be done to prevent a fire spreading to levels and at a speed that is uncontrollable. The second thing is I would really start thinking about what can be done as far as control burn. For many, many years, we stopped control burns for the most part because of air quality, to be able to control air quality. But I think now we have to review that and change a little bit into reinstating control burns and spacing them out in order to assure that we actually meet situations that are not as dramatic and uncontrolled as they were in 2020.
John, how many years have you been making wine? And now, just for our listeners who don't know you, which I can't imagine anybody doesn't know you, you are from Switzerland originally, and you've been making wine in the States for how long?
In the United States since 2001, and prior to that, I think I'm celebrating my 28th vintage. Some years I've made vintages in both the northern and the southern hemisphere, but you know, I in multiple countries, and I can tell you one thing: 2020 as a vintage was devastating because I ended up making very little or no reds, despite the fact that I went in the vineyard many times to taste red grapes, and was able to taste amazing profiles in a year that was really shaping up to be something, a year of balance between freshness and fragrance. We had very early aromatic ripeness, you know, in 2020, and that would have allowed us to pick with at lower breaks ripe fruit, you know, and that would have been an amazing vintage. But, you know, the fires obviously changed dramatically the equation.
It's got to be a heartbreaker because they're your babies, then they're gone.
Yeah, that is, it is really I call it an emotional, you know, connection. When you go in the vineyard and you see what you have farmed or have farmed, you know, all through the year, and suddenly you have these conditions that prevent you from turning these grapes, picking these grapes and turning them into wine, you know, it's really heartbreaking.
Yeah, I can't even imagine. Well, in this long period of time you've been making wine in the States, what changes have you seen? And that could be very general to the wine industry or to specifically Napa, because clearly quite a bit has changed.
Well, yeah, I think first the style of wine has changed. I think because we're America is still a fairly modern wine consumption society. We have a tendency of our pendulum of trends swinging wider. And what do I mean by that? I just mean that when we start looking into and enjoying a certain product, people have to tendencies to go in excess of whatever they produce. You could take, of course, Chardonnay as one, and these big, buttery Chardonnay that people produce for a long time, and then they went the polar opposite to these high, no-oak, stainless steel, very metallic, sometimes extremely acid-driven Chardonnay, and then they settle in the middle. You can go to Cabernet, where, you know, in the 90s and 2000, you had what I called one-night stands, you know, and blockbuster cabs that were sometimes overripe with residual sugar a lot, that were not balanced, you know, opposite of the 70s, where we had elegance, maybe a little bit not enough ripeness sometimes. And now we're moving into an era of balance. And I think that we're just following really the simple curve of learning. In this country, one of the greatest benefits of this country is the ability to learn and learn faster than others to compensate for the lack of history that we have. And I think we're just following the exact same curve.
Yeah, that's very well put. We've lost so much time because of Prohibition. Some of the things that have changed has been packaging. We now have wine in cans, we have bags, we have boxes, we have all kinds of crazy stuff. How do you see these new changes with wines?
Well, actually, I see it as different products. And I'm gonna say I consult for Columbia Crest up in Washington. At Columbia Crest, we make wines, but we make low alcohol wines, we make aroma added wines. And the other day, the winemaker, Katie Nelson, actually sent me a bunch of, you know, aromatic wines in can. And she's like, just taste them, tell me what you think, what's your feedback. And, of course, obviously with the pandemic, you know, we ship more than we actually go. And I tasted these products. And one was packaged in a can with passion fruit on the design, and it was a passion fruit aroma added. And I enjoyed the product. I don't consider it completely wine, to be honest. I consider it a different type of beverage, but it's fun. It's different, and I think it's really destined for a certain bracket of society that needs to come in and be pulled into consuming wine. And one of the greatest things about the wine world, the wine product as a product, is it usually people have a tendency of self-educating themselves. So if you get them to be exposed to wine, whatever it is, white Zinfandel, two buck chuck, low-calorie wine, sweet wine, aromatic wine, whatever it is, They're going to, after that, self-educate themselves up the ladder of quality and different products. And I think that's really what counts.
And most importantly, not judging people for what they start out with, right?
Yeah, or actually, to be honest, right, for me, it's not judging people for anything, because ultimately it's taste. And I don't think it is to anybody's, role to judge somebody. And I'll give you a funny story. I just had a wine that scored the perfect score, on one of my clients. Last one that I made at Alpha Omega in 2018 as a winemaker scored 100 points. And another publication gave it 91. So obviously for somebody it was 100 points, and for somebody else it was 91.
Sure.
So, you know, it also depends so much so on when you taste it and your emotional response to the wine itself.
Sure. And you and I have talked about this a number of times over the years. By the way, congratulations for the 100 points. That was very cool.
Thank you.
What other areas are you consulting right now around the planet or around the country?
I am consulting in Switzerland, Spain, Italy, Edna Valley, Napa, Sonoma, Washington State, and I'm in discussion for North Carolina and Texas.
North Carolina, that's kind of interesting. Well, Texas has certainly become quite a stronghold for wine as well, right?
That is correct. You know, every single of these regions have a true singular DNA and its true challenges. I'm going to start with Napa, right? Napa's biggest challenge is sometimes the heat spell and extreme heat. Texas has its challenges as a shorter growing season, kind of a similar challenge that Washington has for other reasons, because Texas has, you know, a shortened growing season because of extreme heat that pushes your sugar ripeness fairly fast, but not your phenolic ripeness. In Washington, it's actually because they have an earlier frost risk in the season. So every single region where I work and try to help people making wine, it's another dynamic. It's another equation with different parameters. And it is to us to not only analyze them, understand them, and do the best we can within the bracket of that equation.
Nice. Now, this may be a loaded question because we've talked about these areas that you're consulting in now, but just to the United States, is there an area you say right now, wow, this is really an up-and-comer?
That is not already established. I think we are seeing, because of extremes of weather. Okay, everybody can talk about climate change. There is a climate modification. Is it global warming? That's a different story. But there is a climate change, and I think that climate change dictates changes, and actually is showing that we're going to have to adapt either with new varietals, with new practices, sometimes with new technologies. We're going to have to adapt to a different equation and a different system. So I would say it's an ever-evolving answer. It depends on what time frame you're looking at. As for right now, it also depends on the varietals. There's really specific varietals for me that are grown in regions that nobody have heard of. And today, you know, every single state of the U.S. has at least two wineries.
Right.
And so that means what? That somebody is finding interest and a quality product to produce in certain regions. And I won't answer fully your question, Ray, purposely, because I think that every state or every equation is going to have the expression of their terroir, their climate, with their soil, but also with the people that work in the situation. And I think that dictates that the beauty of wine is also its diversity. So some people tell me, I hear sometimes, oh my gosh, how is it possible to grow wine in Virginia? It's disgusting. No, it's not. And as they learn how to handle humidity, fungus pressure, they become better at creating really nice wines that are site-specific. And I think the worst enemy is globalization. So I actually enjoy that all of these people are making wine because they're all different personalities.
Now, that's a great attitude. You know, I've been talking about this one thing, this one great line. I was talking to a woman winemaker in the Finger Lakes region, and she said, you know, you very rarely ever meet a former winemaker.
That is fairly true, because usually people change career to come to winemaking. And I think one of the reasons that is the endless amount of possibility and learning. Every single vintage, every single varietal, every single block changes year every year. And therefore, a lifetime is not enough to be able to explore and master wine. So we constantly, at least I can speak only for myself, I constantly just try to progress, just try to improve. And I think because of that, it keeps the interest going all the time. And you know, there's one, actually, Snowden in Napa, used to be a winemaker, if I'm not mistaken, at Cane, and has a brand, his own brand, but it's his daughter, because he went back to being a judge or an attorney.
Really?
But it's the only example that I know.
Yeah, it doesn't seem to happen too often. It was just such an interesting quote. I've been using it, and I really like thinking about that. You have 365 days of the year that you deal with, whether you're in the vineyard, in the cellar, whatever it might be. In that whole process, in that time, is there a time that's your favorite? Is there one particular time you go, this is what I really gear up for and love?
Yeah, there's two. One is the harvest timing, when do you pick grapes, and the beginning of fermentation, where you really see the personality and potential of your baby, which is really stunning. And the other is blending, because it's kind of taking the personality of people and erasing their faults and trying to maximize their, you know, their qualities. And these are the two things where I really thrive, because again, it's, I think, just when I get the most connection with the product.
Interesting. Funny you should bring up blending, because I was thinking about this before. Having spent a little bit of time with you in the cellar, watching you taste early in the morning, very early in the morning, when, you know, everything's just in the early stages after coming off the vines. Blending is such a specific art form and process. How do you keep it objective? How is it something that you don't get into a house palate or just simply lose your objectivity? Is there something you do?
Yeah, because and that's a great question, and let me explain why. Because I think that, again, if you want to fight against globalization and uniformization of taste, of wine, you have to leave a portion of your belief to just trusting what nature gives you. And part of the issue there is the fact that you cannot, as a winemaker, and you don't have, as a winemaker, the power to erase the gift of nature, and that is a climate, a soil, and a plant. And so as much as I would want to, and there's ways, especially if you turn into very technological winemaking, where you can erase some of these, you know, terroir components, I actually enjoy trying to keep some of these terroir components in the equation to express the difference.
Interesting.
And that keeps me honest in my blending.
Yeah, that's very cool. It's just an amazing process to me. You've done this for such a long time. You've done a lot of media, talked to all kinds of press people. What's maybe the one question that you've never been asked that you'd like to be asked?
Well, the question I would love to have been asked is, what was hard and what made your career difficult? I mean, the position of a winemaker, a consulting winemaker, that's, you know, is employed and usually fairly well media covered, is always seen as something beautiful and easy, but there's some very difficult parts of this job, of this passion. With every deep feeling comes deep wounds. And nobody ever asks about what are the deep wounds. And I think that would be a fairly interesting question.
Well, let's ask that question.
I think the doubt, the feeling you don't know, the feeling every year that when harvest comes, I forgot everything on to how to determine a pick, how to ferment the wine. Every single time I sit at the blending session or table, I feel like I'm not knowing what I do. The fact that when a journalist gives you a score where you believe you should have had much more, the doubt that it triggers in you, and the real work on your not only self-esteem, but on yourself doubting to be able to progress, are definitely some of my wounds. It's I never see it as something that I have or I mastered. Quite the opposite. The doubt is so present in my life, in every day work and operation and decision I make. You know, we just talked about 100 points. 100 points for me is very glorious, and it's very, you know, fulfilling as a compliment. But you go taste the wine, and it is my job to see what can I still better in that wine. What could I have done to still increase this? So when you get a 95 or a 91 or an 89 or just a consumer, a regular consumer that tells you, well, it's not my cup of tea. Mm. It is my role to come in doubt. And sometimes, because this love and passion I have for the wine is so deep and so engraved in my heart and soul, that the doubt and problems that go with it are exactly as deep and hard. And it's not always fun, and it's not always easy.
That was an excellent answer. Very honest. I appreciate that.
Thanks.
Yeah. Well, now we go to the silly question, and what's the weirdest thing you've seen as a winemaker? And I'm sure there's a few weird things.
Well, I think one of the weirdest things I've seen recently is when an owner of a winery employs a team for 15, 20 years and does not realize that their product is not up to par. And the complete disconnect of people that are in the wine industry that just don't understand, you have to be connected in love and passionate about what you do, or you can make crap and not even realize it. So that would be one. The other is sometimes the disconnect from people understanding that despite that is, the wine world is very poetic and very glamorous and very artistic in a way. It is still a business. And the greatest, most powerful, richest person on the face of the planet at one point will still want their venture to be a success, not only media-wise, you know, relationship-wise, visibility-wise, but also financially-wise. And I think it's absolutely key to realize that, because it could be wine, it could be painting, it could, nobody is at one point going to keep on doing something if it cannot be sustained and to pay bills and to have some type of economical sense.
Sure. No, that makes sense. So with the consulting you're doing, are you at this point, have you, will you venture into bubbles?
I just sat into a blending session, my first blending session of bubbles. I actually make bubbles for two different companies, two different wineries. One is Medlock Age, which is where I just came out of. And so we're making a Brut out of Chardonnay and Pinot. And then the other one is Pope Valley Winery. So I actually ventured in really slowly. And I have to give credit to friends like Ludovic Dervin from the ex-mum, a person like Pauline Lott from Dimension, for just answering questions when I text or call them to help me better that. Because when I enter a project like that, to be very direct, I actually tell the owners right away, you know, it's not my forte. Never done it before. I would love to learn. And it is absolutely so exciting to learn, to find yourself in a position where, guess what? I don't know. So help me. And I am in that phase where I'm starting to really kind of see how much more I can progress. And the other thing that kind of is in the same way as this is rosé. I actually learned with Ludovic and other people how to make rosé, but it took me 10 years to really understand rosé, I think. And so it's so enriching, it's so fulfilling to grab bubbles, since you asked, and suddenly measure how much growth there is for me to be better at it.
That's very neat. That's got to be a lot of fun. I think it's fascinating that you're venturing into bubbles because you being from Europe and your background in wine, I think this is something I would love to taste. So hopefully one day we'll get to share a glass in person. But for the time being, since we're doing this on the phone, I'm sure our listeners are going to want to learn more about you. And you've done many virtual tastings. First off, how do people find you? What is your website?
My website is jhwineconsulting.com, and I'm on social media under my name, Jean Effrière, mainly Facebook and Instagram, so feel free. And most importantly, my email is jean@jhwineconsulting.com. If you have any question on wine in general, even wine that I don't make, I would be more than happy to answer it because it's truly what I love. And I love meeting people through the media, through this incredible subject that wine is.
Well, and that's the thing about you. You've always been a great educator. You've always been one willing to share information and never look down at people at whatever level they're at in their journey. So as a fan of yours and a fan of wine, I thank you for that.
Thank you. Thank you very much. I learned from everybody, from you, from any consumer, because there's a lot of things they'll know better, you know, about much more than I do, and you can always learn from anybody, and so I think it's quite key.
Very true. Jean, thanks very much for taking the time. I appreciate it. I hope to see your smiling face in person soon.
Me too. Thank you for having me.
Learn more by visiting jhwineconsulting.com.
Thanks for listening, and remember to like us on Facebook. Also, check out our YouTube channel.
Life Between the Vines is produced at Fifth Floor Recording Company in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Produced and edited by Ray Pfister. Theme song and original music written and recorded by Tim Dondarevo. Additional original music by Ray Pfister. Our host is Kay Paskoff. Our graphics and website specialist is Lawton Hall. Our web geek is Dan Gieschen. Copyright 2020.